process, which is invasion of the organism into the vessel walls of the body. The Andromeda organism didn't get to the lungs or the brain. It didn't get anywhere. But why? We'll know that, Hall said, when we know why a 69-year-old sterno drinker with an ulcer is like a 2-month-old baby. They seem pretty much opposites, Burton said. They do, don't they? Hall said. It would be hours before he realized Burton had given him the answer to the puzzle, but an answer that was worthless. 24. Evaluation. Sir Winston Churchill once said that true genius resides in the capacity for evaluation of uncertain, hazardous, and conflicting information. Yet it is a peculiarity of the Wildfire team that, despite the individual brilliance of team members, the group grossly misjudged their information at several points. One is reminded of Montaigne's acerbic comment, "Men under stress are fools and fool themselves." Certainly the Wildfire team was under severe stress, but they were also prepared to make mistakes. They had even predicted that this would occur. What they did not anticipate was the magnitude, the staggering dimensions of their error. They did not expect that their ultimate error would be a compound of a dozen small clues that were missed, a handful of crucial facts that were dismissed. The team had a blind spot, which Stone later expressed this way. We were problem-oriented. Everything we did and thought was directed toward finding a solution, a cure to Andromeda. And, of course, we were fixed on the events that had occurred at Piedmont. We felt that if we did not find a solution, no solution would be forthcoming, and the whole world would ultimately wind up like Piedmont. We were very slow to think otherwise. The error began to take on major proportions with the cultures. Stone and Levitt had taken thousands of cultures from the original capsule. These had been incubated in a wide variety of atmospheric, temperature, and pressure conditions. The results of this could only be analyzed by computer. Using the growth transmatrix program, the computer did not print out results from all possible growth combinations. Instead, it printed out only significant positive and negative results. It did this after first weighing each petri dish and examining any growth with its photoelectric eye. When Stone and Levitt went to examine the results, they found several striking trends. Their first conclusion was that growth media did not matter at all. The organism grew equally well on sugar, blood, chocolate, plain agar, or sheer glass. However, the gases in which the plates were incubated were crucial, as was the light. Ultraviolet light stimulated growth under all circumstances. Total darkness, and to a lesser extent infrared light, inhibited growth. Oxygen inhibited growth in all circumstances, but carbon dioxide stimulated growth. Nitrogen had no effect. Thus, best growth was achieved in 100% carbon dioxide, lighted by ultraviolet radiation. Poorest growth occurred in pure oxygen, incubated in total darkness.
What do you make of it? Stone said. It looks like a pure conversion system, Levitt said.
I wonder, Stone said. He punched through the coordinates of a closed growth system. Closed growth systems studied bacterial metabolism by measuring intake of gases and nutrients and output of waste products. They were completely sealed and self-contained. A plant in such a system, for example, would consume carbon dioxide and give off water and oxygen. But when they looked at the Andromeda strain, they found something remarkable. The organism had no excretions. If incubated with carbon dioxide and ultraviolet light, it grew steadily until all carbon dioxide had been consumed. Then growth stopped. There was no excretion of any kind of gas or waste product at all. No waste.
Clearly efficient, Stone said.
You'd expect that, Levitt said.
This was an organism highly suited to its environment. It consumed everything, wasted nothing. It was perfect for the barren existence of space. He thought about this for a moment, and then it hit him. It hit Levitt at the same time. Good Christ! Levitt was already reaching for the phone.
Get Robertson, he said. Get him immediately.
Incredible, Stone said softly. No waste. It doesn't require growth media. It can grow in the presence of carbon, oxygen, and sunlight, period.
I hope we're not too late,
Levitt said, watching the computer console screen impatiently. Stone nodded. If this organism is really converting matter to energy, and energy to matter, directly, then it's functioning like a little reactor.
And an atomic detonation.
Incredible, Stone said. Just incredible. The screen came to life. They saw Robertson looking tired, smoking a cigarette.
Jeremy, you've got to give me time. I haven't been able to get through to...
Listen, Stone said, I want you to make sure Director 712 is not carried out. It is imperative. No atomic device must be detonated around the organisms. That's the last thing in the world, literally, that we want to do.
He explained briefly what he had found. Robertson whistled.
We just provide a fantastically rich growth medium.
That's right, Stone said. The problem of a rich growth medium was a peculiarly distressing one to the wildfire team. It was known, for example, that checks and balances exist in the normal environment. These managed to dampen the exuberant growth of bacteria. The mathematics of uncontrolled growth are frightening. A single cell of the bacterium E. coli would, under ideal circumstances, divide every 20 minutes. That is not particularly disturbing until you think about it. But the fact is that bacteria multiply geometrically. One becomes two. Two become four. Four become eight, and so on. In this way, it can be shown that in a single day, one cell of E. coli could produce a super colony equal in size and weight to the entire planet Earth. This never happens for a perfectly simple reason. Growth cannot continue indefinitely under ideal circumstances. Food runs out. Oxygen runs out. Local conditions within the colony change and check the growth of organisms. On the other hand, if you had an organism that was capable of directly converting energy to matter, and if you provided it with a huge, rich source of energy, like an atomic blast.
I'll pass along your recommendation to the president, Robertson said. He'll be pleased to know he made the right decision on the 712.
You can congratulate him on his scientific insight, Stone said. For me. Robertson was scratching his head.
I've got some more data on the Phantom crash. It was over the area west of Piedmont at 23,000 feet. The post team has found evidence of the disintegration the pilot spoke of, but the material that was destroyed was a plastic of some kind. It was depolymerized.
What does the post team make of that?
They don't know what the hell to make of it, Robertson admitted. And there's something else. They found a few pieces of bone that had been identified as human, a bit of humerus and tibia, notable because they are clean, almost polished.
Flesh burned away?
Doesn't look that way, Robertson said.
Stone frowned at Levitt.
What does it look like? It looks like clean, polished bone, Robertson said. They say it's weird as hell. And there's something else. We checked into the National Guard around Piedmont, the 112th is stationed in a 100-mile radius, and it turns out they've been running patrols into the area for a distance of 50 miles. They've had as many as 100 men west of Piedmont. No deaths.
None? You're quite sure?
Absolutely. Were there men on the ground in the area the Phantom flew over?
Yes. 12 men. They reported the plane to the base, in fact.
Levitt said.
Sounds like the plane crash is a fluke.
Stone nodded. To Robertson.
I'm inclined to agree with Peter. In the absence of fatalities on the ground.
Maybe it's only in the upper air.
Maybe, but we know at least this much. We know how Andromeda kills. It does so by coagulation, not disintegration or bone cleaning or any other damn thing. By coagulation.
All right, Robertson said. Let's forget the plane for the time being.
It was on that note that the meeting ended. Stone said, I think we'd better check our cultured organisms for biologic potency.
Run some of them against a rat.
Stone nodded. Make sure it's still virulent. Still the same. Levitt agreed. They had to be careful the organism didn't mutate, didn't change to something radically different in its effects. As they were about to start, the level 5 monitor clicked on and said,
Dr. Levitt. Dr. Levitt.
Levitt answered. On the computer screen was a pleasant young man in a white lab coat.
Yes.
Dr. Levitt, we have gotten our electroencephalograms back from the computer center. I'm sure it's all a mistake, but... His voice trailed off.
Yes, Levitt said. Is something wrong?
Well, sir, yours were read as grade 4, atypical, probably benign, but we would like to run another set.
Stone said.
It must be a mistake.
Yes, Levitt said. It must be.
Undoubtedly, sir, the man said, but we would like another set of waves to be certain.
I'm rather busy now, Levitt said.
Stone broke in, talking directly to the technician. Dr. Levitt will get a repeat EEG when he has the chance. Very good, sir, the technician said. When the screen was blank, Stone said, There are times when this damn routine gets on anybody's nerves.
Levitt said, Yes.
They were about to begin biologic testing of the various culture media when the computer flashed that preliminary reports from X-ray crystallography were prepared. Stone and Levitt left the room to check the results, delaying the biologic tests of media. This was a most unfortunate decision, for had they examined the media, they would have seen that their thinking had already gone astray and that they were on the wrong track. 25. Willis. X-ray crystallography analysis showed that the Andromeda organism was not composed of component parts, as a normal cell was composed of nucleus, mitochondria, and ribosomes. Andromeda had no subunits, no smaller particles. Instead, a single substance seemed to form the walls and interior. This substance produced a characteristic precession photograph, or scatter pattern, of X-rays. Looking at the results, Stone said, A series of six-sided rings.
And nothing else, Levitt said. How the hell does it operate?
The two men were at a loss to explain how so simple an organism could utilize energy for growth.
A rather... common ring structure, Levitt said. A phenolic group, nothing more. It should be reasonably inert.
Yet it can convert energy to matter.
Levitt scratched his head.
He thought back to the city analogy and the brain cell analogy. The molecule was simple in its building blocks. It possessed no remarkable powers, taken as single units, yet collectively, it had great powers.
Perhaps there is a critical level, he suggested, a structural complexity that makes possible what is not possible in a similar but simple structure.
The old chimp brain argument, Stone said.
Levitt nodded.
As nearly as anyone could determine, the chimp brain was as complex as the human brain. There were minor differences in structure, but the major difference was size. The human brain was larger, with more cells, more interconnections. And that, in some subtle way, made the human brain different. Thomas Waldron, the neurophysiologist, once jokingly noted that the major difference between the chimp and human brain was that we can use the chimp as an experimental animal, and not the reverse. Stone and Levitt puzzled over the problem for several minutes until they came to the Fourier electron density scans. Here, the probability of finding electrons was mapped for the structure on a chart
that resembled a topological map. They noticed something odd. The structure was present, but the Fourier mapping was inconstant.
It almost looks, Stone said, as if part of the structure is switched off in some way.
It's not uniform, after all, Levitt said.
Stone sighed, looking at the map.
I wish to hell, he said, that we'd brought a physical chemist along on the team.
Unspoken was the added comment, instead of Hall.
Tired, Hall rubbed his eyes and sipped the coffee, wishing he could have sugar. He was alone in the cafeteria, which was silent except for the muted ticking of the teleprinter in the corner. After a time, he got up and went over to the teleprinter, examining the rolls of paper that had come from it. Most of the information was meaningless to him. But then he saw one item, which had come from the Deathmatch program. Deathmatch was a news-scanning computer program that recorded all significant deaths according to whatever criterion the computer was fed. In this case, the computer was alerted to pick up all deaths in the Arizona, Nevada, California area and to print them back. The item he read might have gone unnoticed were it not for Hall's conversation with Jackson. At the time, it had seemed like a pointless conversation to Hall, productive of little, and consuming a great deal of time. But now he wondered. Print program. Death watch. Death match. 998. Scale. 7, comma. Y, comma. 0, point. X, comma. 4, comma. 0. Print as. Item. From Associated Press. Verbatim. 778-778. Brush Ridge, Arizona. An Arizona Highway Patrol officer was allegedly involved in the death today of 5 persons in a highway diner. Miss Sally Conover, waitress at Dine Ease Diner on Route 15, 10 miles south of Flagstaff, was the sole survivor of the incident. Miss Conover told investigators that at 2:40 a.m., Officer Martin Willis entered the diner and ordered coffee and donut. Officer Willis had frequently visited the diner in the past. After eating, he stated that he had a severe headache and that his ulcer was acting up. Miss Conover gave him 2 aspirin and a tablespoon of bicarbonate of soda. According to her statement, Officer Willis then looked suspiciously at the other people in the diner and whispered, "They're after me." Before the waitress could reply, Willis took out his revolver and shot the other customers in the diner, moving methodically from one to the next, shooting each in the forehead. Then he allegedly turned to Miss Conover and, smiling, said, "I love you, Shirley Temple," placed the barrel in his mouth, and fired the last bullet. Miss Conover was released by police after questioning. The names of the deceased customers are not known at this time. End item verbatim. End print. End program. Terminate. Hall remembered that Officer Willis had gone through Piedmont earlier in the evening, just a few minutes before the disease broke out. He had gone through without stopping, and had gone mad later on. Connection? He wondered. There might be. Certainly, he could see many similarities. Willis had an ulcer, had taken aspirin, and had, eventually, committed suicide. That didn't prove anything, of course. It might be a wholly unrelated series of events, but it was certainly worth checking. He punched a button on the computer console. The TV screen lighted, and a girl at a switchboard with a headset pressing down her hair smiled at him. "I want the chief medical officer for the Arizona Highway Patrol, the Western Sector, if there is one."
"Yes, sir," she said briskly.
A few moments later, the screen came back on. It was the operator.
"We have a Dr. Smithson, who is the medical officer for the Arizona Highway Patrol west of Flagstaff. He has no television monitor, but you can speak to him on audio."
"Fine," Hall said. There was a crackling and a mechanical hum. Hall watched the screen, but the girl had shut down her own audio and was busy answering another call from elsewhere in the wildfire station. While he watched her, he heard a deep, drawling voice asked tentatively,
"Anyone there?"
"Hello, Doctor," Hall said. "This is Dr. Mark Hall in Phoenix. I'm calling for some information about one of your patrolmen, Officer Willis."
"The girl said it was some government thing," Smithson drawled. "That right?"
"That is correct. We require..."
"Dr. Hall,"
Smithson said, still drawling.
"Perhaps you'd identify yourself and your agency."
It occurred to Hall that there was probably a legal problem involved in Officer Willis's death. Smithson might be worried about that. Hall said,
"I am not at liberty to tell you exactly what it is." "Well, look here, Doctor. I don't give out information over the phone, and especially I don't when the fellow at the other end won't tell me what it's all about."
Hall took a deep breath. "Dr. Smithson, I must ask you..."
"Ask all you want. I'm sorry, I simply won't."
At that moment, a bell sounded on the line, and a flat, mechanical voice said, "Attention, please. This is a recording. Computer monitors have analyzed cable properties of this communication and have determined that the communication is being recorded by the outside party. All parties should be informed that the penalty for outside recording of a classified government communication is a minimum of 5 years' prison sentence. If the recording is continued, this connection will automatically be broken. This is a recording. Thank you." There was a long silence. Hall could imagine the surprise Smithson was feeling. He felt it himself.
"What the hell kind of a place are you calling from, anyhow?" Smithson said finally.
"Turn it off," Hall said. There was a pause, a click, then...
"All right. It's off."
"I'm calling from a classified government installation," Hall said.
"Well, look here, mister."
"Let me be perfectly plain," Hall said. "This is a matter of considerable importance, and it concerns Officer Willis. No doubt there's a court inquiry pending on him, and no doubt you'll be involved. We may be able to demonstrate that Officer Willis was not responsible for his actions, that he was suffering from a purely medical problem. But we can't do that unless you tell us what you know about his medical status. And if you don't tell us, Dr. Smithson, and tell us damned fast, we can have you locked away for 12 years for obstructing an official government inquiry. I don't care whether you believe that or not. I'm telling you, and you better believe it." There was a very long pause, and finally the drawl.
"No need to get excited, Doctor. Naturally, now that I understand the situation."
"Did Willis have an ulcer?"
"Ulcer? No. That was just what he said, or was reported to have said. He never had an ulcer that I know of."
"Did he have any medical problem?"
"Diabetes," Smithson said.
"Diabetes?"
"Yeah. And he was pretty casual about it. We diagnosed him 5-6 years ago at the age of 30. Had a pretty severe case. We put him on insulin, 50 units a day. But he was casual, like I said. Showed up in the hospital once or twice in coma because he wouldn't take his insulin. Said he hated the needles. We almost put him off the force because we were afraid to let him drive a car. Thought he'd go into acidosis at the wheel and conk out. We scared him plenty, and he promised to go straight. That was 3 years ago, and as far as I know, he took his insulin regularly from then on."
"You're sure of that?"
"Well, I think so. But the waitress at that restaurant, Sally Conover, told one of our investigators that she figured Willis had been drinking, because she could smell liquor on his breath. And I know for a fact that Willis never touched a drop in his life. He was one of these real religious fellows. Never smoked and never drank. Always led a clean life. And that was why his diabetes bothered him so. He felt he didn't deserve it."
Hall relaxed in his chair. He was getting near now, coming closer. The answer was within reach, the final answer, the key to it all. One last question, Hall said. Did Willis go through Piedmont on the night of his death?
Yes. He radioed in. He was a little behind schedule, but he passed through.
Why?
Is it something about the government tests being held there?
No, Hall said. But he was sure Smithson didn't believe him.
Well, listen, we're stuck here with a bad case, and if you have any information which would...
We will be in touch, Hall promised him, and clicked off. The girl at the switchboard came back on.
Is your call completed, Dr. Hall?
Yes, but I need information.
What kind of information?
I want to know if I have the authority to arrest someone.
I will check, sir. What is the charge?
No charge. Just to hold someone. There was a moment while she looked over at her computer console.
Dr. Hall, you may authorize an official Army interview with anyone involved in Project Business. This interview may last up to 48 hours.
All right, Hall said.
Arrange it. Yes, sir. Who is the person?
Dr. Smithson, Hall said. The girl nodded, and the screen went blank. Hall felt sorry for Smithson, but not very sorry. The man would have a few hours of sweating, but nothing more serious than that, and it was essential to halt rumors about Piedmont. He sat back in his chair and thought about what he had learned. He was excited and felt on the verge of an important discovery. Three people, a diabetic in acidosis from failure to take insulin, an old man who drank Sterno and took aspirin, also in acidosis, a young infant. One had survived for hours. The other two had survived longer, apparently permanently. One had gone mad. The other two had not. Somehow, they were all interrelated. In a very simple way. Acidosis, rapid breathing, carbon dioxide content, oxygen saturation, dizziness, fatigue. Somehow, they were all logically coordinated, and they held the key to beating Andromeda. At that moment, the emergency bell sounded, ringing in a high-pitched, urgent way as the bright yellow light began to flash. He jumped up and left the room. 26. The Seal. In the corridor, he saw the flashing sign that indicated the source of the trouble. Autopsy. Hall could guess the problem. Somehow the seals had been broken and contamination had occurred. That would sound the alarm. As he ran down the corridor, a quiet, soothing voice on the loudspeaker said,
"Seal has been broken in autopsy. Seal has been broken in autopsy. This is an emergency."
His lab technician came out of the lab and saw him.
"What is it?"
"Burton, I think. Infection spread.
Is he all right?"
"Doubt it," Hall said, running. She ran with him. Levitt came out of the morphology room and joined them, sprinting down the corridor around the gentle curves. Hall thought to himself that Levitt was moving quite well for an older man, when suddenly Levitt stopped. He stood riveted to the ground and stared straight forward at the flashing sign and the light above it blinking on and off. Hall looked back. "Come on," he said. Then the technician.
"Dr. Hall, he's in trouble."
Levitt was not moving. He stood, eyes open, but otherwise he might have been asleep. His arms hung loosely at his sides.
"Dr. Hall."
Hall stopped and went back. "Peter, boy, come on. We need you." He said nothing more, for Levitt was not listening. He was staring straight forward at the blinking light. When Hall passed his hand in front of his face, he did not react. And then Hall remembered the other blinking lights, the lights Levitt had turned away from, had joked off with stories. "The son of a bitch," Hall said. "Now, of all times."
"What is it?"
the technician said. A small dribble of spittle was coming from the corner of Levitt's mouth. Hall quickly stepped behind him and said to the technician, "Get in front of him, cover his eyes. Don't let him look at the blinking light."
"Why?"
"Because it's blinking 3 times a second, Hall said.
"You mean?"
"He'll go any minute now." Levitt went, with frightening speed. His knees gave way and he collapsed to the floor. He lay on his back, and his whole body began to vibrate. It began with his hands and feet, then involved his entire arms and legs, and finally his whole body. He clenched his teeth and gave a gasping, loud cry. His head hammered against the floor. Hall slipped his foot beneath the back of Levitt's head and let him bang against his toes. It was better than having him hit the hard floor. "Don't try to open his mouth," Hall said. "You can't do it. He's clenched tight." As they watched, a yellow stain began to spread at Levitt's waist. "He may go into status," Hall said. "Go to the pharmacy and get me 100 milligrams of phenobarb, now in a syringe. We'll get him onto Dilantin later if we have to." Levitt was crying through his clenched teeth like an animal, his body wrapped like a tense rod against the floor. A few moments later, the technician came back with a syringe. Hall waited until Levitt relaxed, until his body stopped at seizures, and then he injected the barbiturate. "Stay with him," he said to the girl. "If he has another seizure, just do what I did. Put your foot under his head. I think he'll be all right. Don't try to move him." And Hall ran down to the autopsy lab. For several seconds, he tried to open the door to the lab, and then he realized it had been sealed off. The lab was contaminated. He went on to main control and found Stone looking at Burton through the closed-circuit TV monitors. Burton was terrified. His face was white, and he was breathing in rapid, shallow gasps, and he could not speak. He looked exactly like what he was, a man waiting for death to strike him. Stone was trying to reassure him. "Just take it easy, boy. Take it easy. You'll be okay. Just take it easy."
"I'm scared," Burton said. "Oh, Christ, I'm scared."
"Just take it easy," Stone said in a soft voice. "We know that Andromeda doesn't do well in oxygen. We're pumping pure oxygen through your lab now. For the moment, that should hold you." Stone turned to Hall. "You took your time getting here. Where's Levitt?"
"He fitted," Hall said.
"What?"
"Your lights flashed at 3 per second, and he had a seizure."
"What?"
"Petit mal. It went on to a grand mal attack. Tonic-clonic seizure, urinary incontinence, the whole bit. I got him onto phenobarb and came as soon as I could."
"Levitt has epilepsy?"
"That's right," Stone said.
"He must not have known. He must not have realized."
And then Stone remembered the request for a repeat electroencephalogram.
"Oh," Hall said, "he knew all right. He was avoiding flashing lights, which will bring on an attack. I'm sure he knew. I'm sure he has attacks where he suddenly doesn't know what happened to him, where he just loses a few minutes from his life and can't remember what went on."
"Is he all right?"
"We'll keep him sedated,"
Stone said. "We've got pure oxygen running into Burton. That should help him until we know something more."
Stone flicked off the microphone button connecting voice transmission to Burton.
"Actually, it will take several minutes to hook in, but I told him we've already started. He's sealed off in there, so the infection is stopped at that point. The rest of the base is okay, at least."
Hall said. "How did it happen, the contamination?"
"Seal must have broken," Stone said. In a lower voice, he added, "We knew it would, sooner or later. All isolation units break down after a certain time."
Hall said, "You think it was just a random event?"
"Yes," Stone said, "just an accident. So many seals, so much rubber of such and such a thickness. They'd all break given time. Burton happened to be there when one went."
Hall didn't see it so simply. He looked in at Burton, who was breathing rapidly, his chest heaving in terror. Hall said, "How long has it been?" Stone looked up at the stop clocks. The stop clocks were special timing clocks that automatically cut in during emergencies. The stop clocks were now timing the period since the seal broke.
4 minutes,
Hall said. "Burton's still alive."
"Yes, thank God."
And then Stone frowned. He realized the point.
"Why,"
Hall said, "is he still alive?"
"The oxygen. You said yourself the oxygen isn't running yet. What's protecting Burton?"
At that moment, Burton said over the intercom,
"Listen, I want you to try something for me."
Stone flicked on the microphone.
"What?"
"Callison,"
Burton said.
"No,"
Stone's reaction was immediate.
"Damn it, it's my life."
"No," Stone said. Hall said, "Maybe we should try."
"Absolutely not. We don't dare, not even once."
Callison was perhaps the best-kept American secret of the last decade. Callison was a drug developed by Jensen Pharmaceuticals in the spring of 1965, an experimental chemical designated UJ-44759W, or K9 in the short abbreviation. It had been found as a result of routine screening tests employed by Jensen for all new compounds. Like most pharmaceutical companies, Jensen tested all new drugs with a scatter approach, running the compounds through a standard battery of tests designed to pick up any significant biologic activity. These tests were run in laboratory animals, rats, dogs, and monkeys. There were 24 tests in all. Jensen found something rather peculiar about K9. It inhibited growth. An infant animal given the drug never attained full adult size. This discovery prompted further tests, which produced even more intriguing results. The drug, Jensen learned, inhibited metaplasia, the shift of normal body cells to a new and bizarre form, a precursor to cancer. Jensen became excited and put the drug through intensive programs of study. By September 1965, there could be no doubt. Callison stopped cancer. Through an unknown mechanism, it inhibited the reproduction of the virus responsible for myelogenous leukemia. Animals taking the drug did not develop the disease, and animals already demonstrating the disease showed a marked regression as a result of the drug. The excitement at Jensen could not be contained. It was soon recognized that the drug was a broad-spectrum antiviral agent. It killed the virus of polio, rabies, leukemia, and the common wart. And, oddly enough, Callison also killed bacteria, and fungi, and parasites. Somehow, the drug acted to destroy all organisms built on a unicellular structure or less. It had no effect on organ systems, groups of cells organized into larger units. The drug was perfectly selective in this respect. In fact, Callison was the universal antibiotic. It killed everything, even the minor germs that caused the common cold. Naturally, there were side effects. The normal bacteria in the intestines were destroyed, so that all users of the drug experienced massive diarrhea. But that seemed a small price to pay for a cancer cure. In December 1965, knowledge of the drug was privately circulated among government agencies and important health officials. And then for the first time, opposition to the drug arose. Many men, including Jeremy Stone, argued that the drug should be suppressed. But the arguments for suppression seemed theoretical, and Jensen, sensing billions of dollars at hand, fought hard for a clinical test. Eventually the government, the HEW, the FDA, and others agreed with Jensen and sanctioned further clinical testing over the protests of Stone and others. In February 1966, a pilot clinical trial was undertaken. It involved 20 patients with incurable cancer and 20 normal volunteers from the Alabama State Penitentiary. All 40 subjects took the drug daily for 1 month. Results were as expected. Normal subjects experienced unpleasant side effects, but nothing serious. Cancer patients showed striking remission of symptoms consistent with cure. On March 1st, 1966, the 40 men were taken off the drug. Within 6 hours, they were all dead. It was what Stone had predicted from the start. He had pointed out that mankind had, over centuries of exposure, developed a carefully regulated immunity to most organisms. On his skin, in the air, in his lungs, gut, and even bloodstream were hundreds of different viruses and bacteria. They were potentially deadly, but man had adapted to them over the years, and only a few could still cause disease. All this represented a carefully balanced state of affairs. If you introduced a new drug that killed all bacteria, you upset the balance and undid the evolutionary work of centuries, and you opened the way to superinfection, the problem of new organisms bearing new diseases. Stone was right. The 40 volunteers each had died of obscure and horrible diseases no one had ever seen before. One man experienced swelling of his body from head to foot, a hot, bloated swelling until he suffocated from pulmonary edema. Another man fell prey to an organism that ate away his stomach in a matter of hours. A third was hit by a virus that dissolved his brain to a jelly. And so it went. Jensen reluctantly took the drug out of further study. The government, sensing that Stone had somehow understood what was happening, agreed to his earlier proposals and viciously suppressed all knowledge and experimentation with the drug Callison. And that was where the matter had rested for 2 years. Now Burton wanted to be given the drug. "No," Stone said, "not a chance. It might cure you for a while, but you'd never survive later when you were taken off."
"That's easy for you to say from where you are."
"It's not easy for me to say, believe me. It's not." He put his hand over the microphone again to Hall. "We know that oxygen inhibits growth of the Andromeda strain. That's what we'll give Burton. It will be good for him. Make him a little giddy, a little relaxed, and slow his breathing down. Poor fellow is scared to death." Hall nodded. Somehow Stone's phrase stuck in his mind. Scared to death. He thought about it, and then began to see that Stone had hit upon something important. That phrase was a clue. It was the answer. He started to walk away. "Where are you going?"
"I've got some thinking to do."
"About what?"
"About being scared to death."
27. Scared to death. Hall walked back to his lab and stared through the glass at the old man and the infant. He looked at the two of them and tried to think, but his brain was running in frantic circles. He found it difficult to think logically, and his earlier sensation of being on the verge of a discovery was lost. For several minutes, he stared at the old man while brief images passed before him. Burton, dying, his hand clutched to his chest. Los Angeles in panic, bodies everywhere, cars going haywire, out of control. It was then that he realized that he, too, was scared. Scared to death. The words came back to him. Scared to death. Somehow, that was the answer. Slowly, forcing his brain to be methodical, he went over it again. A cop with diabetes. A cop who didn't take his insulin and had a habit of going into ketoacidosis. An old man who drank Sterno, which gave him methanolism and acidosis. A baby who did what? What gave him acidosis? Hall shook his head. Always he came back to the baby, who was normal, not acidotic. He sighed. "Take it from the beginning," he told himself. "Be logical. If a man has metabolic acidosis, any kind of acidosis, what does he do? He has too much acid in his body. He can die from too much acid, just as if he had injected hydrochloric acid into his veins. Too much acid meant death. But the body could compensate by breathing rapidly, because in that manner the lungs blew off carbon dioxide and the body's supply of carbonic acid, which is what carbon dioxide formed in the blood, decreased. A way to get rid of acid. Rapid breathing. And Andromeda. What happened to the organism when you were acidotic and breathing fast? Perhaps fast breathing kept the organism from getting into your lungs long enough to penetrate the blood vessels. Maybe that was the answer. But as soon as he thought of it, he shook his head. No, something else. Some simple, direct fact. Something they had always known, but somehow never recognized. The organism attacked through the lungs. It entered the bloodstream. It localized in the walls of arteries and veins, particularly of the brain. It produced damage. This led to coagulation, which was dispersed throughout the body, or else led to bleeding, insanity, and death. But in order to produce such rapid, severe damage, it would take many organisms, millions upon millions, collecting in the arteries and veins. Probably, you did not breathe in so many. So they must multiply in the bloodstream, at a great rate, a fantastic rate. And if you were acidotic, did that halt multiplication? Perhaps. Again, he shook his head. Because a person with acidosis, like Willis or Jackson, was one thing. But what about the baby? The baby was normal. If it breathed rapidly, it would become alkalotic, basic, too little acid, not acidotic. The baby would go to the opposite extreme. Hall looked through the glass, and as he did, the baby awoke. Almost immediately, it began to scream, its face turning purple, the little eyes wrinkling, the mouth toothless and smooth-gummed, shrieking, scared to death. And then the birds, with the fast metabolic rate, the fast heart rates, the fast breathing rates, the birds who did everything fast, they too survived. Breathing fast. Was it as simple as that? He shook his head. It couldn't be. He sat down and rubbed his eyes. He had a headache and he felt tired. He kept thinking of Burton, who might die at any minute. Burton sitting there in the sealed room. Hall felt the tension was unbearable. He suddenly felt an overwhelming urge to escape it, to get away from everything. The TV screen clicked on. His technician appeared and said, "Dr. Hall, we have Dr. Levitt in the infirmary." And Hall found himself saying, "I'll be right there." He knew he was acting strangely. There was no reason to see Levitt. Levitt was all right, perfectly fine, in no danger. In going to see him, Hall knew that he was trying to forget the other, more immediate problems. As he entered the infirmary, he felt guilty. His technician said, "He's sleeping." "Post-ictal," Hall said. "Persons after a seizure usually slept."
"Shall we start Dilantin?"
"No. Wait and see. Perhaps we can hold him on phenobarb." He began a slow and meticulous examination of Levitt. His technician watched him and said,
"You're tired."
"Yes," said Hall. "It's past my bedtime." On a normal day, he would now be driving home on the expressway. So would Levitt, going home to his family in Pacific Palisades, the Santa Monica Expressway. He saw it vividly for a moment, the long lines of cars creeping slowly forward, and the signs by the side of the road, speed limit 65 maximum, 40 minimum. They always seemed like a cruel joke at rush hour, maximum and minimum. Cars that drove slowly were a menace. You had to keep traffic moving at a fairly constant rate, little difference between the fastest and the slowest, and you had to... He stopped. "I've been an idiot," he said, and he turned to the computer. In later weeks, Hall referred to it as his highway diagnosis. The principle of it was so simple, so clear and obvious, he was surprised none of them had thought of it before. He was excited as he punched in instructions for the growth program into the computer. He had to punch in the directions three times. His fingers kept making mistakes. At last, the program was set. On the display screen, he saw what he wanted. Growth of Andromeda as a function of pH, of acidity-alkalinity. The results were quite clear. The Andromeda strain grew within a narrow range. If the medium for growth was too acid, the organism would not multiply. If it was too basic, it would not multiply. Only within the range of pH 7.39 to 7.43 would it grow well. He stared at the graph for a moment, then ran for the door. On his way out, he grinned at his assistant and said, "It's all over. Our troubles are finished." He could not have been more wrong. 28. The test. In the main control room, Stone was watching the television screen that showed Burton in the sealed lab.
"The oxygen's going in," Stone said.
"Stop it," Hall said.
"What?"
"Stop it, now. Put him on room air." Hall was looking at Burton. On the screen, it was clear that the oxygen was beginning to affect him. He was no longer breathing so rapidly. His chest moved slowly. He picked up the microphone. "Burton," he said, "this is Hall. I've got the answer. The Andromeda strain grows within a narrow range of pH. Do you understand? A very narrow range.
If you're either acidotic or alkalotic, you'll be all right. I want you to go into respiratory alkalosis. I want you to breathe as fast as you can. Burton said,
But this is pure oxygen. I'll hyperventilate and pass out. I'm a little dizzy now.
No, we're switching back to air. Now start breathing as fast as you can. Hall turned back to Stone. Give him a higher carbon dioxide atmosphere.
But the organism flourishes in carbon dioxide.
I know, but not at an unfavorable pH of the blood. You see, that's the problem. Air doesn't matter, but blood does. We have to establish an unfavorable acid balance for Burton's blood.
Stone suddenly understood.
The child, he said. It screamed.
Yes.
And the old fellow with the aspirin hyperventilated.
Yes.
And drank Sterno besides. And both of them shot their acid-base balance to hell, Stone said.
Yes, Hall said. My trouble was, I was hung up on the acidosis. I didn't understand how the baby could become acidotic. The answer, of course, was that it didn't. It became basic, too little acid. But that was all right. You could go either way, too much acid or too little, as long as you got out of the growth range of Andromeda.
He turned back to Burton. All right now, he said. Keep breathing rapidly. Don't stop. Keep your lungs going and blow off your carbon dioxide. How do you feel?
Okay, Burton panted. You're scared, but okay.
Good. Listen, Stone said. We can't keep Burton that way forever. Sooner or later.
Yes, Hall said.
We'll alkalinize his blood. To Burton, look around the lab. Do you see anything we could use to raise your blood pH?
Burton looked.
No, not really.
Bicarbonate of soda, ascorbic acid, vinegar?
Burton searched frantically among the bottles and reagents on the lab shelf and finally shook his head.
Nothing here that will work.
Hall hardly heard him. He had been counting Burton's respirations. They were up to 35 a minute, deep and full. That would hold him for a time, but sooner or later he would become exhausted. Breathing was hard work, or pass out. He looked around the lab from his vantage point, and it was while doing this that he noticed the rat, a black Norway, sitting calmly in its cage in a corner of the room, watching Burton. He stopped.
That rat...
It was breathing slowly and easily. Stone saw the rat and said,
What the hell?
And then, as they watched, the lights began to flash again, and the computer console blinked on. Early degenerative change in gasket V-112-6886.
Christ, Stone said.
Where does that gasket lead?
It's one of the core gaskets. It connects all the labs. The main seal is...
The computer came back on. Degenerative change in gaskets A-009-5478, V-430-0050, N-966-6656.
They looked at the screen in astonishment.
Something is wrong, Stone said.
Very wrong.
In rapid succession, the computer flashed the number of 9 more gaskets that were breaking down.
I don't understand.
And then Hall said,
The child, of course.
The child?
And that damned airplane. It all fits.
What are you talking about? Stone said.
The child was normal, Hall said. It could cry and disrupt its acid-base balance.
Well and good. That would prevent the Andromeda strain from getting into its bloodstream and multiplying and killing it.
Yes, yes, Stone said. You've told me all that.
But what happens when the child stops crying?
Stone stared at him. He said nothing.
I mean, Hall said, that sooner or later, that kid had to stop crying. It couldn't cry forever. Sooner or later, it would stop, and its acid-base balance would return to normal. Then it would be vulnerable to Andromeda.
True.
But it didn't die.
Perhaps some rapid form of immunity. No, impossible. There are only two explanations. When the child stopped crying, either the organism was no longer there, had been blown away, cleared from the air, or else the organism changed, Stone said. Mutated. Yes, mutated to a non-infectious form. And perhaps it is still mutating. Now it is no longer directly harmful to man, but it eats rubber gaskets. The airplane, Hall nodded. National Guardsmen could be on the ground and not be harmed, but the pilot had his aircraft destroyed because the plastic was dissolved before his eyes. So Burton is now exposed to a harmless organism. That's why the rat is alive. That's why Burton is alive, Hall said. The rapid breathing isn't necessary. He's only alive because Andromeda changed. It may change again, Stone said. And if most mutations occur at times of multiplication, when the organism is growing most rapidly, the sirens went off, and the computer flashed a message in red. Gasket integrity zero. Level 5 contaminated and sealed. Stone turned to Hall. Quick, he said. Get out of here. There's no substation in this lab. You have to go to the next sector. For a moment, Hall did not understand. He continued to sit in his seat, and then, when the realization hit him, he scrambled for the door and hurried outside to the corridor. As he did so, he heard a hissing sound and a thump as a massive steel plate slid out from a wall and closed off the corridor. Stone saw it and swore. That does it, he said. We're trapped here, and if that bomb goes off, it'll spread the organism all over the surface. There'll be 1,000 mutations, each killing in a different way. We'll never be rid of it. Over the loudspeaker, a flat mechanical voice was saying, The level is closed. The level is closed. This is an emergency. The level is closed. There was a moment of silence, and then a scratching sound. As a new recording came on, and Miss Gladys Stevens of Omaha, Nebraska said quietly, There are now 3 minutes to atomic self-destruct. 29. 3 minutes. A new rising and falling siren came on, and all the clocks snapped their hands back to 1200 hours, and the second hands began to sweep out the time. The stop clocks all glowed red, with a green line on the dial to indicate when detonation would occur. And the mechanical voice repeated calmly, There are now 3 minutes to self-destruct. Automatic, Stone said quietly. The system cuts in when the level is contaminated. We can't let it happen. Hall was holding the key in his hand. There's no way to get to a substation. Not in this level. Each sector is sealed from every other. But there are substations on the other levels. Yes. How do I get up? You can't. All the conventional routes are sealed. What about the central core? The central core communicated with all levels. Stone shrugged. The safeguards. Hall remembered talking to Burton earlier about the central core safeguards. In theory, once inside the central core, you could go straight to the top. But in practice, there were ligamine sensors located around the core to prevent this, originally intended to prevent escape of lab animals that might break free into the core. The sensors released ligamine, a curare derivative that was water-soluble in the form of a gas. There were also automatic guns that fired ligamine darts. The mechanical voice said, There are now 2 minutes 45 seconds to self-destruct. Hall was already moving back into the lab and staring through the glass into the inner work area. Beyond that was the central core. Hall said, What are my chances? They don't exist, Stone explained. Hall bent over and crawled through a tunnel into a plastic suit. He waited until it had sealed behind him, and then he picked up a knife and cut away the tunnel like a tail. He breathed in the air of the lab, which was cool and fresh and laced with Andromeda organisms. Nothing happened. Back in the lab, Stone watched him through the glass. Hall saw his lips move, but heard nothing.
Then a moment later, the speakers cut in, and he heard Stone say, "Best that we could devise."
"What was?"
"The defense system."
"Thanks very much," Hall said, moving toward the rubber gasket. It was circular and rather small, leading into the central core.
"There's only one chance," Stone said. "The doses are low. They're calculated for a 10-kilogram animal, like a large monkey, and you